Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene.
Welcome to The Crime Scene. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And we're going to enter some very disturbing territory today. Our guest is renowned author Mark Olshaker, and he has a new book out along with legendary FBI profiler John Douglas. It is called The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators with the FBI's Original Mindhunter. Now, Mark is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and author of 10 nonfiction books and 5 novels, including Einstein's Brain and The Edge. His multiple books with former FBI special agent and criminal profiling pioneer John Douglas, beginning with Mindhunter and most recently Law and Disorder, have sold millions of copies and have been translated into many languages. Mindhunter is now a dramatic series on Netflix directed by David Fincher. And Mark and his wife live in Washington, D.C. Mark, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
I think obviously you all have a great relationship. You've done so many books together and done so many things. What is it like to work with the father of profiling, criminal profiling? What is it like?
Well, that's an interesting story. I am a writer, as you know, and a documentary filmmaker, writer, and producer. And the way I first got to know John is I was doing projects for NOVA, the PBS science series.
Sure.
And way back in the 1990s, I told the producer of NOVA in Boston that I had read this book called Silence of the Lambs, a novel, and I thought it was really good. And I understood that they were making a movie out of it. And if the movie was anywhere near as good as the book, I thought it was going to be a big hit. So I said, why don't we go in to the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, and tell the real story of these profilers behind the Silence of the Lambs novel and movie. And they finally agreed. We went in. This was long before profilers and serial killers became such a social phenomenon that everybody wanted to do it. So the FBI was very willing. We went in. We researched cases. We filmed the unit. We came up with a film called Mind of a Serial Killer, which was nominated for a national Emmy. John Douglas was the main character in it, main real character. And when he got ready to retire a couple of years later, he called me and said, do you think anybody would be interested in my story? And I said, well, I certainly am. And what had happened is I said, you know, novelists and nonfiction writers alike are always looking for great characters, whether they're real or fictional. And John was just this amazing character, already a legend in the criminal justice world, but not really known to the public. And I said, yeah, this is great. I'd love to team up with him. And over the years, Jim, I guess I've become the Watson to John Sherlock Holmes.
Now, you mentioned it a little bit there, and I certainly want to get to the book shortly, but I want to get your opinion on this. As you said, the idea of serial killers books and movies and things on Netflix, and certainly the big cable networks like HBO and podcasts. Even though I've been doing this show for several years before the big craze, but the point is that everybody wants to get in on this. Now, I guess it's kind of maybe a bad example, but a double-edged blade here, because on one hand, I think it's probably a cultural positive because it serves as a cautionary tale and tells people that there are bad people out there that will do horrible things. I think that's a positive. But then again, maybe it's getting a little too popular, a little too much entertainment into it. What are your thoughts about this? Because certainly you were at the leading edge with John.
Yeah, well, I think you've raised a very interesting question and probably a complex one. I think the reason for the fascination, on one side, it's like any other vicarious thrill, like a roller coaster or jumping out of an airplane, that seems relatively safe but gives a thrill anyway. But I think on a more profound level, it's really about true crime is really about the human condition, but it's the human condition writ large at the extremes. We all have these feelings. We all have these emotions, love, hate, jealousy, revenge, retribution, anger, whatever. But we're writing about people who act on them all, who don't have the social inhibitions that the rest of us do, who don't have the empathy or compassion or sense that other people matter. And this is both scary, but also profoundly revealing about the continuum of the human race. So I agree with you. I think that when it gets to be merely entertainment, it can be dangerous or certainly deleterious to society. We try never to make these people into glamorous figures, which they're not. And at the same time, we are always, always cognizant of the role of the victim and what the victim's suffering and ordeal is. Because when you think about it, Jim, a violent crime, the perpetrator creates a relationship between himself, and it's almost always him rather than her, and the victim. It's a relationship the victim doesn't want, but it's a relationship that exists, and therefore we have to balance that out.
Now, I'm sure you've developed a theory on this over time, working with John and examining all of these cases. People ask the question of, is there really evil in the world? Now, some people will say these are mentally deranged people. They have obvious mental issues, and that's it, full stop. And then other people will say, well, there's element of evil in this, of darkness, maybe even something slightly supernatural. I kind of fall in the middle. I think there are cases of just stone cold mental illness, but then I do think there could be an element of evil here. What, from your perch, you've seen more of this than most people. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you've brought up a profoundly important question, and I tend to agree with you. I'm somewhere in the middle, and I think John is too. Let us acknowledge that anybody who takes a life in cold blood, not in defensive positions, not in the military or whatever, anybody who just takes a life wantonly in cold blood is mentally ill. Almost by definition, they would have to be. But that doesn't mean that they don't understand the difference between right and wrong. That doesn't mean they can't conform their behavior to the dictates of society, which, going all the way back to the Macnaghten rule in 1700s England, is really been the definition of insanity, which of course is a legal term. So I would say to you and to the listeners out there and all of our readers that if someone is truly delusional, if he doesn't understand what he's doing, if he's lost contact with reality, yes, that person would probably be not guilty by reason of insanity. But short of that, these people do what they do, and it's very hard for ordinary people like us to understand. They do what they do because it's the most important thing in their lives, because they enjoy it, because it gives them satisfaction. They get to manipulate, dominate, and control situations that ordinarily they have no power in. And this is a tremendous high for these people.
And the lengths they go to.
Yes, I would say that to me, that's evil.
And the lengths they go to cover it up.
Correct.
I mean, again, the idea is that if you're truly insane, if you truly have lost touch with reality and don't know what you're doing right from wrong, you're not going to have the wherewithal or even the disposition to try to cover it up.
You're absolutely right, Jim. Remember, a serial killer, by definition, is a successful killer. Someone who's killed more than once he learns what to do, and he perfects his modus operandi so that he gets better and better at it. And fortunately, most of them have fatal flaws so that we eventually catch up with them. And what John and his colleagues are trying to do with profiling is try to cut that process short.
Well, let's talk about the methodology a little bit. Mm-hmm. What was different about what John Douglas and his partner did than what came before? What of many innovations did they bring to this, to interfacing with the serial killer, understanding the why, and helping them catch other bad guys?
Prior to behavioral profiling, the FBI and every other law enforcement agency was pretty much facts, just the facts, ma'am, as the old Dragnet show. I'm dating myself by referring to that, but that's what they did. What John and his colleague Robert Ressler did is they went into the penitentiaries. They started talking to the killers themselves, the violent offenders, the predators, and by talking to them and knowing everything about the case to begin with so that the killers couldn't con them, and talking to them for extended periods so they could actually take them back mentally to the time of the crime, they were able to correlate what was going on in the offender's mind before, during, and after the offense with the evidence left at the crime scene. And that was a tremendous leap forward because it could then be correlated with physical evidence, with scientific evidence, with the autopsy protocols, to give them much more of an understanding of what kind of person would do these crimes. Now, having said that, there's certain crimes that it doesn't work for at all. You know, a routine street robbery, a bank robbery, perhaps, or a holdup, they're too ordinary. You could give a profile, but the profile would fit thousands of people. But the kind of sexually based, lust based, predatory crimes that they deal with, these are the ones that really lend themselves to behavioral profiling, and where the crime scene evidence will show a lot that the police can use to narrow their suspect list.
In terms of serial killers, it seems like so many of them you hear of, there's some kind of sexual component. Are serial killings almost by definition something that have some kind of strange and deviant sexual piece to them?
In most cases, yes. And what we have to do is we have to expand our definition of a sexual component. For example, David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam in the 1970s, who terrorized New York as the 44 caliber killer, he would walk up to cars with a man and a woman, a young man and a young woman inside, and he would fire at both of them and kill both of them. Never touched either victim, never sexually assaulted them, but yet it was definitely a sexual crime, a crime of power. He would come back to the crime scenes very often, he told John, and masturbate at the crime scenes just thinking about what he had done. And what was very interesting is he started essentially his criminal career as an arsonist. And he would go to the scene of the fires, and he would masturbate just over the power that he had to create this this horrible scene. So yes, you're absolutely right. There's almost always a sexual component, but we have to loosen our definition.
Now, what things did the original profilers do to make the serial killers open up? What kind of things I had read, you know, not recording or some different things. What were some of the comforting things, for lack of a better phrase, they did to make these monsters open?
Well, you mentioned the recording, and that's actually one of the few literary licenses that the Netflix series Mindhunter takes. They actually recorded the first interview with Ed Kemper, who features prominently in the first season, and they found that these guys, by definition, being in prison, they're fairly paranoid. So if you're recording, they're going to be even more paranoid. So what they realized was that they shouldn't record, they shouldn't take notes, they should just listen intently. And as soon as they got out of the interview, they would fill out a 57-page protocol that basically answered all of the questions that they had brought up. But in terms of directly answering your question, you have to know the case completely, you have to understand it, and you have to be willing to take the time to establish a rapport, not necessarily agreeing with the prisoner, but not condemning him either, because you want to get him to talk. And eventually taking him back to the scene of the crime. Now, why they did it, why they would agree, some of them were bored, some of them didn't, killers don't get many visitors by and large. Some thought maybe it would help their parole chances or the way they were treated in the prison if they were perceived as cooperating with the feds, as long as it didn't get out to the prison population, because they didn't want to be known as snitches. And some of them just liked thinking they could outwit an FBI agent. So there were a multitude of reasons. But what was interesting is almost nobody turned them down. At first, Richard Speck, the killer of five student nurses in Chicago, he didn't want to talk to them. And as is actually shown in the Mindhunter series, John finally said, he figured out he had to get down to Speck's level, and he said something like, you know, you took out five really nice looking women. He didn't exactly use those words. I'm being a little bit diplomatic here. What gave you the right to do that? But he said it in fairly rough terms, and Speck looked at him and said, you guys are as crazy as I am. All right, what do you want to know? And he ended up talking to them.
And I've got to believe, at least in some of the cases, that the serial killers probably enjoy retelling it because it's kind of an ego trip to say, I did this, you know, this thing that they consider to be so great, maybe.
No question about that. Absolutely. And so what we tried to do in our new book, The Killer Across the Table, since there is such fascination with this process, we decided to take four cases that John had worked on, where he interviewed violent offenders in prison, serial killers, and say, all right, these are not cases that people know much about. They haven't been publicized. So we'll give background on the Specks and the Mansons and the Kempers and the Berkowitzes and all of the others. But we're going to tell four stories that you probably don't know, each one completely different. One man who was actually a high school science teacher with a master's degree killed a six-year-old Girl Scout, Brownie, actually, who came to his front door collecting for Girl Scout cookies. Another is a man who raped and murdered young girls, but rather than find strangers, as most people do, he raped and murdered the daughters of his friends because he felt it was easier to get them into his control. I mean, just totally, totally bizarre. And then we have another one. We think of people like Ted Bundy as being the most prolific serial killers in history, but in fact, John interviewed the most prolific serial killer in American history, a man named Donald Harvey. And why was he so prolific? He was a nurse's aide, and he was able to kill people in hospital situations and healthcare situations. And he killed them right under the authorities' noses, and they never even noticed because these were sick people who, you know, might have died anyway. So he'd killed nearly 100 people before he was discovered.
Well, I'm looking at a picture of Harvey right now, and he looks mild-mannered. He looks you look at him and like, that looks like a trustworthy guy.
Sure does.
I mean, is that, you know, that's always it's always the quiet ones or the ones that you don't suspect. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
People looked right through him.
Wow. That's just amazing.
Yeah, I agree with you.
The lack of the, and you can talk about these four cases because you anticipated my question. That was the next one about this book. The lack of empathy. How does that work? Because I just can't. I can imagine a scenario. Let's say somebody is having a heated argument, you know, and right. somebody maybe gets in a little bit of a physical altercation and they fight, and somebody punches somebody and they accidentally fall down, hit their head, and they die. That I'm not saying it's good, but I can understand how a normal person, they lost control. That could happen, like a manslaughter kind of thing.
But Jim, the fact that you can't imagine that speaks to your own humanity.
Right.
Absolutely. It's hard for people like you and me, and presumably our listeners, to understand that to these people, everyone else is an object. Nothing else matters. It's whatever they want to do to these people, they feel entitled to. And I think the trying to anticipate your next question, the psychology behind it is, in virtually every one of these cases, the ones that we talk about in The Killer Across the Table and all of the other people that we've studied over the years, warring within these people are conflicting emotions of deep-seated inadequacy combined with a feeling of total grandiosity and entitlement, that the world hasn't given them what they deserve, and so they're entitled to take it, or they're above other people. And so you have people like Dennis Rader, the BTK strangler, who had a wife and a family, two children, and he had a job. But the most important thing in his life was what he considered his projects, which was going out and finding people, stalking them, breaking into their houses, and then sexually assaulting them, binding them, torturing them, and murdering them. And what he really got off on was watching them die, knowing that they were going to die at his hand. That was the ultimate power for him.
Have you ever run into...
It's hard for us to understand, but that's the way it is.
Have you ever run, and it could be any of these four cases or any others, where they've truly had remorse, or is it more just remorse for being caught?
Absolutely. Occasionally, you do find somebody who's remorseful, but by and large, it's they feel sorry for themselves. One-time killers, sometimes, you know, you can bring them around. But anybody who is killed repeatedly, it's because he wants to. And they generally don't feel remorse except for themselves. And, you know, you can lock up their bodies, but you can't lock up their minds. And most of them will spend the rest of their years in prison reliving the glory of these crimes that they committed.
One of the quotes you have in the book here, killing for me was just like second nature.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the man who said that, Joseph Kondro, after he raped and murdered the young girl who was the daughter of friends of his and buried her body out in the woods, he then went back and met his own ex-wife for a parent-teacher meeting at their son's school.
I mean, how much of a difference do you think these techniques have made over the years? How many serial killers have they stopped? How many more people may have fallen at the hands of these? What difference have these techniques and methodologies made, do you think?
That's a very good question. And the one thing we have to understand is we are not going to stop crime any more than soldiers are going to stop war or doctors are going to stop disease. It's an ongoing battle that we have to keep fighting. What I will say is that this understanding, these profiling techniques that came out of interviewing violent offenders in prison have probably cut short the careers of a lot of criminals, and not only serial killers, serial bombers, terrorists, assassins. So they really have contributed to law enforcement's understanding of how they operate, to the prosecution's ability to strategize how to present their cases so that the juries understand what these people are really like. John and his colleagues have often testified as expert witnesses in prison to explain to juries just what you and I are talking about now, Jim. And so there's no way of knowing, but we certainly feel that we have cut down the length of the careers of a lot of these people and helped the police to find them much earlier.
Now, the thing is I think we're entering an interesting era. You have the techniques that Douglas and company developed, and now you're bringing into the equation DNA. It reminds me of in the early days of HIV, I think the way they tried to fight it was a cocktail of drugs. You know, you've got this kind and this kind. And now you've got these techniques, and then you layer on that DNA, which we know, of course, famously helped bring or brought down the Golden State Killer, it seems. And I mean, how do you feel with the advent of this and hope that longstanding cases like the Zodiac and so forth are solved?
Well, you know, if evidence is preserved properly, that's a real possibility. And what is most beneficial and most useful is when the DNA evidence, when the behavioral evidence, when the autopsy evidence and everything else, when it all comes together, you can be sure that you've got a good outcome. I'll give you an example of how DNA and profiling might come together. I was on Mark Furman's radio show out in Idaho a number of times, usually by phone, and they had a serial killer case out there, a typical type case where the killer was killing prostitutes. Unfortunately, they're a very vulnerable population. And he said to me one time, "Well, we've got about 16 cases, and they have, and a source of ours in the police department says they have DNA on 8 of them. So, what do you think this tells us about the killer?" So I stopped for a minute, and then I thought, and then I said, "Well, you know, the killer has been pretty successful, so I doubt he's being wounded a lot of the time. So I don't think that the DNA is blood. It's probably semen. But on the other hand, prostitutes are very careful, and they would insist on condoms. So I don't think they're finding the semen inside the victim's bodies. So what this tells me is this man is coming back to the crime scenes after death, post-mortem, after he's killed these women, and he is masturbating on their bodies to relive the crime scenes. And that's what it turned out to be. So there's a perfect example of how scientific evidence and behavioral evidence can come together to help solve a crime.
Very, very disturbing indeed, but great that the sciences are coming together to help bring these people to justice. I was going to ask you another thing when you think about BTK, or I believe in, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name right, Todd Kolnep, who you profile in this book, that actually the capture and holding holding captive people, that's a terrifying element of this in
Absolutely.
Many times as well.
And Todd Kolnep, which is one of the cases we profile in The Killer Across the Table, he's an interesting case because, you know, a lot of these killers are really marginal in society. Todd Kolnep was a prominent real estate agent and broker in South Carolina who was making $350,000 a year. He'd also killed 7 people. And what you're referring to, Jim, is that he was caught when authorities, sheriff's deputies discovered a woman. People might remember this case, a woman who was being chained up in a shipping container on his property out in the woods. She'd been there for 6 weeks already when they discovered her. And that kind of blew his whole case wide open. And the obvious answer is, oh, well, he's keeping her as a sexual slave, which so many of these serial killers had done. We can cite numerous cases of that. But that turned out not to be what was happening. What really happened is that he had killed her boyfriend, didn't want to kill her, but didn't know what to do with her. So, you know, what do you do in that case? And he never really resolved it.
Oh, my.
And that's what led to his capture.
And in the Cleveland area where I'm from, we had this famous case several years ago, Ariel Castro and three women.
And that really was a sexual slavery kind of case, as I recall, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. One of the women had a child while they were there. But just a horrible, horrible case. And actually, the one one woman now is dedicating her time. She's doing a lot of work with one of the local television stations, doing missing people's reports and things. And that's really a case of someone that's had Amanda Berry. She's had a tough go of it. I can't think of anything much tougher. And she's trying to turn it into a positive. So good for her.
Yes, and you do find that people who've been victimized and their families very often turn themselves to these kind of altruistic efforts. And, you know, you just got to have tremendous admiration for them, for their courage and for their dedication.
After seeing this up close and personal and going over these cases, I always like to ask people, how in the world do you go out of your house or let anybody you care about go out of your house? Because it's really terrifying.
Well, it is. And my wife and I don't have children, but everybody who does, we see how that can be very terrifying. When I was observing John and all his colleagues at the time when they all had teenage children, they were very skeptical about anybody coming along with their children. I've always joked, but it's not really a joke, that I would hate to be the teenage daughter of an FBI agent, because they know what can happen and they're always looking out for it.
And I think this is all, we kind of started the interview talking about a cautionary tale. Now, again, a couple of people have sent me messages, well, you're victim blaming. It's like, no, I'm not victim blaming, but I think it is important, because I have all the respect in the world for victims, and I know that you work on victims' rights, and I think that is a great thing. But what are some things that over the years that these serial killers prey upon? What are some things that we can avoid so as not to play into their hands?
They have an uncanny ability to recognize weakness. It's like the, John always says, it's like the lion on the Serengeti plain. He may see a thousand animals down there, and he finds the one springbok or whatever that looks the weakest and looks the most vulnerable. In the same way, a predator can go into a video arcade or something at a mall, and he will sense who the vulnerable child is. So it's very important to for parents to understand this. And, you know, we say a victim is never, ever responsible. On the other hand, if you're going to put yourself in a risky situation, you do have to take precautions. So, you know, that kind of speaks for itself. But one of the things we teach people, we try to teach people, Jim, is that everybody can be a profiler in a way. I mean, if you have a young child and you tell him or her not to speak to strangers, if she gets lost in a shopping mall, say, she has to speak to strangers. So telling her not to speak to strangers is not helpful, and it might just make her more vulnerable. So what we have to do is teach this little girl to be a profiler, to understand who are safe people to talk to. Well, who are safe people to talk to for a six-year-old girl? Okay, well, somebody in a uniform, somebody with a name tag, somebody behind a desk, a woman with children, a pregnant woman. Any of these are very, very, very likely to be safe people who can help her. So that's what I mean when I say everybody and every one of us can use profiling in one way or another.
Yeah, I know that even doing these shows, you do kind of a little more suspicious and a little more trying to keep yourself out of certain situations.
I'm sure you are. I'm looking at your website right now, and I see crime scene number 178. So clearly, you've been through a lot of these.
Yes, a lot of these discussions. But few have as been enlightening and interesting as this one. Our guest has been Mark Olshaker. He is the co-author of the book, The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking the Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators with the FBI's original Mindhunter. Mark, where can people find the book and the other books and more information about all of your work with John?
You can find the book on Amazon or in your local bookstore. All of the books are available there from Mindhunter on up. I think this is our 8th or 9th book now. Our website is called mindhunters.net, mindhunters.net. And you can find the pictures that go along with this book and all information about us and other other blogs and other help. Jim, you're a terrific interviewer. You really know what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. And it's been very kind for Mark Olshaker to spend some time with us. Again, the book is The Killer Across the Table. Mark, thank you so much for taking time today.
Thank you, Jim.
A very interesting show indeed. I'm sure Mark would agree. Be careful out there. We'll talk to you next time on The Crime Scene. Bye-bye, everybody.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.